Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming out to the Bay Area Book Festival and to this panel specifically. My name is Stephen Sparks, and along with my wife, I'm the owner of Point Reyes Books in Point Reyes Station. This panel put together, I'm also a member of the steering committee of the book festival, which means I just get to make a wish list of which writers would be great to have out at the book festival, including these three here who are very much on my list. And then other people do all the hard work. So thanks again for coming. I want to make a few acknowledgments at the beginning here to thank the Barbara Osher Pro Suiza Foundation, the Icelandic Literature Center, and to Literary Hub, lidhub.com, for sponsoring this event. And again, to thank you all for coming out. Just a couple logistical things after the our conversation and audience Q&A. Katie, Jonas, and Adni will be signing books just across the street. So you exit through the foyer here and just across the street, the booksmith is selling books, so you can look for the stall outside there. And so with that, I think each writer will introduce themselves. We're going to start with Jonas, who will talk a little bit about his book in relation to the panel, which is called Collecting the Pieces. It's about fiction and trauma. And I think it should lead to a very interesting conversation. We'll go from Jonas to Adni to Katie. They're going to introduce themselves and read a short passage from the book, and then we'll talk for a bit. Thank you.
So my name is Jonas Hassan Kemiri. Jonas Hassan Kemiri is what you say in Swedish. I always try to find myself trying to sound American when I say it, Jonas Hassan Kemiri. But in Swedish, my mother tongue, I would say, Jag heter Jonas Hassan Kemiri, which is my, how you would say it in Swedish. I was told maybe 7 minutes ago that I was expected to kind of introduce the book and link it to this theme. So I will try to do that, maybe by just talking a little bit about the book and how it's... So my latest novel... it's called Everything I Don't Remember, and it is my fourth novel. The book deals with, there are more than one trauma in the book, but it starts off with a car running into a tree, one could say. We know that there's a young man called Samuel who has died in a car accident. And a writer who is kind of reminiscent of the person who's sitting here today with the microphone hears about this car accident and decides that he wants to investigate this incident and try to find out what really happened. So the writer goes around asking all the people who knew Samuel and tries to map out his last day alive, trying to find out what really happened. So he speaks to Samuel's friends, family, and his ex-girlfriend, trying to understand who Samuel really was. The problem is that everyone seems to remember him differently. Like, Samuel is not one person. As we read the novel, we realize that he was actually, as we all are, many different persons with many different, depending on who you speak to, he is a different person. So, my entry point into this, maybe we can return to that, but one of the things that I was fascinated with when writing this is how we are influenced by how we remember things. And I thought about that just walking into this room, because I've been here before. I have a memory of this room. 2 years ago, I was at this festival, and I was doing a panel, and it was just like this, but one writer was missing. There was one writer who was not present. She was only her name. So when she was introduced, the moderator gave like a really good introduction of her, and all of us were kind of imagining who she was because she was not here. Like, I remember constructing her in my head as this grand old Italian, very stereotypical idea of a grand old Italian woman. And of course, if you only hear the bio of someone, it's easy to make them into a magnificent person. And then 20 minutes in to the thing, she arrived. And it became this weird clash between what we had imagined of her and her, because she was, as all of us, a person with, you know, kind of Italian English and not the person. I realized that I actually remember the person I created in my head more vividly than the real person, in a way. And my memory has always worked like that. I've always been very interested in how we kind of can, in the void of physical presence, how we can imagine ourselves free, or how we can imagine people who are not present. And I think that was one of the keys into writing this novel. I was curious to see when a person dies, when we lose someone, what happens to our memories of that person. So I'm just going to do a very short reading. When Lyda, Samuel's ex-girlfriend, talks about him, because a number of people say in the center of the novel there's this love story, and some people say that it was a love story. Lyda, who was a part of this love story, is a little bit more reluctant to say that it was a love story. So I'm just going to read a short passage in the voice of Lyda where she speaks about Samuel. And I'm going to read a few sentences in Swedish, so you hear it in Swedish, and then I'm going to read it in English. Jag tror att jag älskade honom. Ta bort tror, jag älskade honom. Jag älskade honom på ett sätt som jag aldrig älskat någon innan. Jag älskade honom trots att vi ännu inte hade sovit ihop. I think I loved him. Take out think. I loved him. I loved him in a way I've never loved anyone else. I loved him even though we hadn't slept together. I loved him because he whooped like a little boy when he laughed and shed a tear like an old lady when it was windy, because his pointy canine teeth made him look like a cat, and because his big head balanced so regally on his thin shoulders, and because his shabby clothes made him look like a person who had more important things to think about than laundry or sewing on buttons, and because he smelled like a human and not a cologne factory. I loved him because he transformed all my earlier relationships into random asides, and sometimes I felt a strong urge to call up on my old boyfriends and say that I had to take a few things back. When I said I was in love, I wasn't in love. And when I said I enjoyed our conversations, I was exaggerating. And when I said you were funny, I was lying. And when I said I loved you, I didn't know any better. And when I ended it and said it wasn't you, it wasn't me, that wasn't true either, because it wasn't my fault. I wasn't the broken one. There was something wrong with you. I just hadn't met the right person, and once I did, it didn't start with a storm of emotions that slowly weakened into a calm breeze that later turned into stiflingly calm everyday life, with nail clipping in front of the TV and arguments about missing phone chargers. My relationship with Samuel was the opposite. We started with daily life, with long conversations between friends, which later, several months later, turned into kisses and closeness and an intimacy that I don't know how to describe it. But yes, I loved him. I truly did.
And now Adni.
Hello. My book is called Land of Love and Ruins, and it's in a diary form, and I think maybe the diary form in itself is a way to deal with trauma a lot. Like, it's like an old way of people to deal with their own trauma. And I wanted this book to be written the way many diaries are, where you are confusing many things. You're like in one day and then on one page, there are very like big questions and small questions and things that really matter and then things that do not really matter. But it's about a woman. It's autobiographical, so it's about me. When I found out that something was wrong in my life, I had no place for myself. I was coming out of a love affair, a love relationship, and I was wondering, how is it possible to keep your own creative space and somehow your space of playfulness in a relationship? And And then at the same time, I was asking myself those questions. My country, Iceland, was going, had this huge economic crisis. So, and realized that there were guys that had been lying to us, that we thought that everything was going so right, but it was going really wrong. And that's a huge shock for a nation. And then maybe the third trauma is about place, finding a place for one's own. But I was also thinking about places that people, like in this pilgrimage, like when people move away from Iceland and moved away to America in the 19th century, because they didn't find any land, because there were just few, maybe rich, taking over the land, and the poor had to leave. And then they are coming back, and they want to go to the spots where their ancestors lived, and they want to go and somehow touch the earth of their loved ones. And people that were escorting them said that very often, or almost always, when people touched the ground, they started to cry. And somehow it was like opening up those old wounds somehow. And so one big character of the book is my brother, which is an archaeologist. So he is always opening the earth and like digging for old wounds, but not only wounds also. So I go on a pilgrimage in this book to try to go to my ancestors' places and try to learn, and also to other people's places, to learn something from there, what they did wrong, if I could somehow learn something from it, because it's so meaningless if there is this huge gap between the generations and between the times, and you cannot learn, you feel that you are not learning anything. So I thought I would try learning something and building my own house and my own space, constructing a space within a relationship, but also like physically finding a place where people are not suffocating or people can breathe. And this, of course, goes also to the big scale about a political system. Like, how can you build a political system where there is like real democracy, where you are not, where you are giving everyone space? And I was thinking that I want to read a chapter that's about, it starts by a reference to a friend of mine that lived under a totalitarian rule in Hungary. And then I go on to remember my mother when I was a teenager and I saw her lying on the couch and she was so sad. And I understood that something was really wrong, and I didn't dare. I was afraid to go to her and touch her and console her, because she had this protective, she had like protected herself from the pain, and her protection shield was so strong that I was just afraid of it. And I've been thinking about this protective shield that people make around themselves, you know, when they come home from school and they have had a very bad day and they try to make a place to play and find this playfulness, or if they have to leave home because in the home they cannot play. So I think writers do that a lot. They somehow invent this space where they can be playful somehow, and that is the best cure for trauma. So I'm reading. Sorry, I'm talking very long. Yeah. No. Yeah. Stykkishólmur, Feast of the Visitation, New Moon. What did he call himself again, the Hungarian professor? A dog. Said that he'd invented animal names for everyone he knew during the totalitarian period, when everything was under surveillance. I waited excitedly for him to say my name, and finally it was my turn to be called into the animal kingdom, Greetings, and may good fortune ever come your way, Teddy Bear. Later, I received a long poetic letter that began with a salutation. Good day to you, Teddy Bear Queen. I can't sleep, hear the hoofbeats of an old satyr. It dashes in from the horizon and leans on me, panting. Are you surprised you're all alone, crazy old Teddy Bear? Remember when you were going to blow up your unhappiness and accidentally blew up everything instead? Time bombs are always wrongly timed, and lying pollutes your inner lakes, the clouds turn gray from anxiety. It was a holiday, and I had prepared everything so well, wanted to be impeccably hospitable. But because I had heard someone say something untrue earlier in the evening and didn't want to start the new year with things left unreckoned from the old one, so much tension was generated that it was as if lightning blasted me in the head. I blew up just before the fireworks were set off, the truth or life. A black, scorched ring formed around me, and no one dared enter it, except for my brother. He is an expert on ruins, stepped in over the line, put his arms around me, and said he understood me. I've been thinking about this step, how big it is, when someone comes and lays a conciliatory hand on a wound. Mom came to me whenever I felt bad, and I remember when I realized that I could do the same, go to her. She lay on the couch, tired after her attempt to lighten the mood in the house. I didn't know whether she wanted to be alone and felt as if there were a blue veil, enveloping her. I was afraid of this veil. I thought I would never get through it, and even if I did, then what? But I decided to slip through the invisible membrane, and she was happy to have me close. We went out into the yard together and decided on a place to put a little shed. I think that in the housing of the future, there needs to be a little healing nook where you can lie down as if under the grass or down in the ground and let the earth restore you. Thank you.
And now Katie.
Hi, I'm Katie. I wrote a novel called A Separation, which is my third book. And it's about a woman who is only recently separated from her husband when she is told that he's gone missing. So she travels to a remote part of Greece in order to look for him. And I think maybe a little bit like Jonas's novel, it's a novel that circulates around an absence. It's, you never kind of meet, it's a bit of a plot spoiler, but you never really meet the character of the husband, and he's instead a character who exists solely in the imagination of his estranged wife. And I think when I started writing the book, in fact, throughout the process of writing the book, I thought I was writing a book that was maybe about marriage and infidelity, but in fact, it was only when I finished writing it that I realized it was really a book that's about grief. And maybe we can talk a little bit about the relationship between grief and trauma, because I think they are very distinct. But one thing that came up in the book was this idea of a grief that wasn't, that couldn't be directly expressed, and the idea that that kind of indirection was part of what led to a trauma. So the central character is not, she and her husband haven't told anybody that they're separated. So in a way, she's still performing the role of the wife, but she herself is not actually, doesn't feel herself to be his wife. So there's a question about authenticity. There's a question about what she is actually allowed to feel in her position. I'm just going to read a quick scene, which takes place in the home of a professional mourner. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with this tradition, which exists around the world, but is particularly strong in the Mani, which is a part of Greece. And these are women who are paid to mourn, to issue laments at funerals. And so there's this idea that rather than expressing your grief yourself, you pay somebody else to do it for you. And so there's this kind of, outsourcing of emotion, I suppose, is one way of putting it. And it's, I think it's particularly appropriate for my narrator, who I think has trouble accessing her emotions directly. So I'm just going to read a quick scene from there. She paused, adjusting the folds of her skirt with her hands. She cleared her throat again and then began to sing. Her voice was low and throaty. She began almost tentatively, as if growing accustomed to its weight. Raising one hand in the air, she sang in a series of atonal registers. She seemed then to find the thread she had been seeking, her fingers pulled together against her thumb, as though she were drawing it through the air. Her voice, as it unfolded across the room, was not beautiful. It was heavy and awkward as the boulders that marked the Mani landscape, a collection of rocks. The notes dropped out of her mouth and tumbled across the room, first one, and then the next, and then the next. They accumulated, the room was soon full of their discordance. She continued, her voice growing in volume, the objects in the room vibrating, the sound of her singing transforming the kitchen interior where we sat. She began slapping her hand against the table. She closed her eyes and then she rocked back and forth, her hand still keeping rhythm. Her voice raised an octave or two. She began to make a high keening sound, and as I listened, transfixed, I saw that there were tears gathering in her eyes, which she had opened very slightly, her head still tilted back. The tears rested on the bottom rim of her eye for a long moment before slowly trickling down. She paused for a ragged intake of breath and then continued, as if she were in a trance, her eyes now wide open, the lamentation pouring out of her, her face wet with tears. I looked at Stefano. I wanted her to stop. She was in pain, and to what purpose? I felt at once the extent of my deception. I was not writing a book. I was not researching the ritual of mourning. There was nothing I could learn from her grief, whose authenticity I did not doubt. Notwithstanding the fact that it was a performance, essentially on demand, the entire situation a fabrication. And I understood that this was why she was paid, not because of her vocal capabilities, not even for the considerable strength of her emoting, but because she agreed to undergo suffering in the place of others. She did stop at last, and Stefano handed her a tissue, which she used to wipe away her tears. She took a glass of water. She did not make eye contact with me. I thought she looked as she drank the water and waved away Stefano's concerned attentions, embarrassed, as though she had been caught making a scene. I too felt embarrassed and soon stood up. She waved goodbye in a half-hearted way. I didn't know how to ask Stefano about leaving some money for her, so I left some bills on a table by the door. It didn't feel like the right thing to do. I saw Stefano glance at the bills, but he didn't say anything. It was still raining when we left, and we walked quickly to the car to avoid the rain. Thank you.
One of the interesting things about reading three books back to back to back under the sort of rubric of a panel like this is you think of them differently than you would if you were just reading these three novels, even if you read them sequentially, and sort of the connections that get made between them that maybe just aren't there on the surface. I think this idea that you just mentioned, that Katie mentioned about absence, weighs heavily in each of these. And sort of how we deal with absence in the way that it is so sort of paradoxically present in each of these three books. And sort of the panel was organized under this idea of like, how do we structure these feelings? And each of these three books is structured in a very singular way, personally. And I wonder if each of you in succession or however the mood strikes, could kind of talk about, so Jonas has this kind of Rashomon-like mosaic, and it's all organized around this absence, but in their characters' lives, there's nothing more present than this loss. And I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit in relation to sort of grief and trauma.
Well, I think it's very paradoxical, this feeling of when you lose someone, how that person can become even more present due to the fact that that person is not alive anymore. Like, one of the things that this book grew out, like, the plan, oftentimes when I don't know how it is for you guys, oftentimes I think that now I know how to write a novel. Now I'm like, the earlier books were attempts, but now I know, I got my thing down, you know, I'm a professional now. And then I make this plan, I get like an Excel sheet, I think I can control what the book is going to be about. And I start writing and it's dead. Like, nothing comes alive. But this book started out with that idea of writing kind of a contemporary love story. And I wrote, and it was just nothing that felt good enough. And then, you know, there's no easy way to say that, but I had a friend who passed away. I had a friend who died. And in the course of writing this novel, I realized that this is actually what the novel is about. It's about what happens when you lose someone and all of a sudden you start questioning the value of words, because that is my experience. Whenever I lose someone, like being it a friend or a relative or something, the moment when that happens, one of the first impulses is that I question what I've been doing all my life. I've been sacrificing or putting an enormous big portion of my life into collecting words. And whenever I lose someone, those words seem very worthless. Mm-hmm. And the next impulse is, I want to write them back. I can actually write them back. Like, I remember when my grandfather passed away, I was 12 or 13. I was writing my personal diary. And I was, when he passed away, it felt, you know, there was this weird feeling of void. Like, he was not present in the family. My first impulse was that, well, what if I write down everything I remember of him in a way that is, I could rebuild him through my words in a way. And I think in this novel that is what happens. We have a number of characters who all have this feeling of guilt, a feeling of maybe I could have done something differently, maybe I could have called more or being more present in the life of Samuel. And then they're being asked to share their memories of him. And so what they share is not only what they remember of him, but they share the things that are kind of comfortable in remembering. The things that create guilt and loss are things that they kind of exclude from their own narratives about him. So we get to know them maybe through what they remember, but even more through what they choose to omit in a way, what they choose not. That, hence the title, Everything I Don't Remember. We get to know them through what they choose not to tell in a way. And we as readers have to construct Samuel. Wow. So that is how the novel is built up. And as we read, hopefully this is, I don't want to spoil anything, but we realize also that the writer has a secret agenda, that he has another story that he's not able to tell. So therefore he has to use Samuel's story to, yeah, some stories are too painful to tell, so you have to circle around them in order to make them come alive, I guess.
And so, Adni, in your book, which is written as a diary, it's on the face of it, you would sort of assume that you're just going to write it all out, and you're going to remember everything by writing. You're in a diary. This is a personal space. But even in that space, there are, and in your book, I think it's dealing with both sort of a personal trauma and like a larger planetary trauma, what we're doing to the environment. And so you're dealing with big issues. But there are also, I feel like there are things that you kind of elide or you pass over that even in this personal space that are still, in the way that Jonas said, kind of too sensitive even to put into words, or maybe there's not language for it.
Yeah, I think maybe it takes many books to get to that, you know, finally maybe you can tell really the truth or something like that. You can really tell it. So it takes many books to, for me it's important to as I, the space that I'm telling, like the space for telling the truth, and then so it's just I'm preparing, heating up for then like my next book after this one. There it was very direct. It was about my own attempt to try to have a child, and I couldn't. So it was really like traumatic and sorrowful. And there I decided to, no, I'm not going to circle around it. I'm just going to go directly to like and send it out to the world like a letter to God or something, like a help letter or something, like a help SOS. And but even then, you know, even then when I try to be so direct, it's all full of little absurd little theaters in here, and it's like a puppet theater. So I guess that's my way somehow. I like puppet theaters, so it's somehow like my books are, yeah. And my first autobiography I published in 2004. It was named Opening of the Hunts. I saw myself like an hunchback. I was young, but I felt like an old hunchback. And I had to get something out of it. And the subtitle was a puppet theater. But the loss in my book, yeah, it's about also this nature protecting thing that we are like, it's an issue of the whole world, of course, that's really that we have in common. And so like a symbol of that is this interior of Iceland, the wasteland, or the highland wasteland, that for so many years some politicians thought that this was nothing, that nothing was there, and it was of no value somehow, because it was just black sand and just glaciers and nothing interesting. And yeah, so when you feel that this highland is little by little taking away from you, then there is you feel a grief or a sorrow that's on a very somehow big scale, you know?
Yeah, which is even sometimes even harder to get at because it's so sort of amorphous. You can't see those changes immediately. That we can kind of pivot here. This idea of a landscape, and sort of landscape that's both internalized and reflective of the external landscape, shows up a lot in your book, where the narrator of Katie's book is very restrained and is sort of restrained by sort of the culture that she's born into, and this also seems like there's some other personal issues there. But sort of the things that aren't said are reflected, I think, in the landscape. And I wonder how you structured it that way or why.
Yeah, I mean, I spent 3 weeks in this little village called Hierro Limenas, which is in the Mani, over, I think, about a decade ago. And it was a very kind of particular time in my life. My dad had been sick with cancer for probably 5 or 6 years by then, and I remember very distinctly. It was while I was there, and I was in this very, you know, it's a sublime landscape in the real sense of the word. And I remember it was there that I accepted that he wasn't going to get better. So it wasn't that I don't think I was yet at the stage of accepting he was going to die, but I understood he wasn't going to recover. And so the entire landscape, as I remembered it, was very much colored by this sense of anticipatory grief, and then also this real sense of dread. And I think that dread is part of what pulls through the book. And then I went back home, and I wrote a draft of this book in the third person, probably, so that would have been, I don't know, 8 years ago or something, and it really wasn't working. It was very dead on the page, and I set it aside, and then I've never looked at it again. I don't know what it's like, but I shortly after the birth of my son, I sat down and I wrote this in the first person, without looking at the previous version of it, and I wrote it quite quickly. And I think one reason maybe why that switch to first person was actually quite important was because by that time I kind of understood how, in a funny way, how inorganic memories are, and how much they're constructed and how much they're tended, especially the memories of somebody who you've lost. So, you know, the moment my dad died, I started endlessly kind of cultivating the memories I had, and I would kind of cherish them, and I'd bring them out, and I'd replay them, and that's kind of how they gain their power, but they also lose some of their power. And so I think for that reason, once I started writing in the first person, the instability of the character, there's never a moment when you get an objective assessment of either the husband or their relationship, and instead it's always colored by the present tense of where she is. And I think there's this kind of in third person, I mean, it's still possible to do that, but I think I really wanted to convey the sense that everything that was happening in her present life had colored and kind of taken away the past from her. Mm-hmm. Somewhere.
Sorry. I think that worked beautifully in the novel also when you introduce these small moments of doubts, who you could trust, if you could trust the mother or the husband, and those doubts about what they, the doubts almost became, I felt when reading it, that it became almost like a fuel when reading the novel, because at the core there is this mystery, like what really happened, and that's kind of a driver. I could see that there were links between the two novels here also, because when someone is not present, the memories that the people who are left have, as you say, they become more cherished. And my experience is also that in the disappearance of the real person, it's almost like it opens up for possibilities of manipulation. Like, now the real person is gone, so I definitely have to defend my version of who he or she was. In my personal experience, it was this friend who passed away, and her body was not present anymore. But our memories of her, everyone who lived while she was not alive anymore, we kind of, the memories that we had became supercharged. I remember especially the memories that I had where I was alone with her, when there were no one else, like it felt that they may, that these memories became very, very unstable, because I was the only one kind of carrying them. So that made her, in a way, it's this weird feeling, like you said earlier, that in the absence of that person, she became super present. And I had weird experiences that I also put in the novel. Like one time I was walking with my son in Stockholm, and I heard her voice. What is that? Like, I don't have a religious belief, so I could convince myself that that was a real voice, but I heard her calling me. And it was not like one of those Hollywood cries, you know, like, ah, Jonas. It was kind of, she was kind of irritated. Like I was like 20 minutes late to, like, Jonas, like, and she had a very peculiar voice as well. And it was like, I physically stopped and I took out my headphones and I realized, no, that's right. This is the world and she's not part of it anymore. But even today, it's a very weird experience. Trying to make myself realize that in a way.
In a way that we talk about memories as if they're these ossified things that you can just go access in your mind, right? You're like, okay, here's this thing I remember. But there are all of these books, and I think all of us have the experience that is memory can be manipulated and is, and as you just said, it sort of, it grows and evolves and changes. And I think each of these three books, in a way, deal with that issue very strongly. And that ties into truth, you know, which is a lot of us, I think, lately. My wife and I got into a lift the other day, and the driver immediately launched into this thing about, he was listening to Forum, and it was about fake news, you know, like we're like, okay. But this idea of truth and a novelist's, one of a novelist's main jobs is to sort of both access what is true, and a lot of times that just means it's ambiguous, and we need to learn to live with that ambiguity. And each of these is a quest. Each of these novels is a quest in some ways after the truth. Adni, yours certainly, and it feels so personal, and it moves, as you said earlier, between the sort of the micro and the macro. And I wonder if you can speak a little bit about how, both as a novelist and a person, that you, what this value and meaning and search for truth entails, as to what you're putting down on the page, and what you hope to get out of it. That's so vague. I could tell by the look.
What I want to get out of it is truth.
True, yeah.
No, it's I think, yeah, if talking about trauma again, it is like if you have experienced that truth is taken away from you, or like you are not able to speak out. Either in a national like context or a personal context, that you don't dare say what you want to say. It is so this is so dramatic for a person, either if it is at home or if it's in school or if it's somewhere else, this is one thing, that you cannot tell the truth. And then the other thing is that somebody else is not telling the truth. And this is very important in later life in love affairs. And also in, as a child, if your parents are not telling the truth, not only about the Santa Claus or something, but like more maybe important. Or this this space, well, I saw like this interior of Iceland, like this wasteland. I saw it like this is very important to have it inside persons also, to keep intact some space of, I would not say maybe purity, but I don't know what word to use. Something that does only belong to you, and if somebody invades it or takes it away from you somehow, then it's very dramatic. So I'm very much wanting to. But then I'm using my own life, yes. And for me, it's not such an interesting question if everything is true, is everything that I write here is really true about my life. Of course, I make sometimes a little variations, and it's like there is a fiction involved. But for me, if the tone is true, somehow, or the intention, yeah, that's. Can I add a little about the puppet theater?
Yes.
Because I remember.
Please do.
Sorry. I hope it's not very boring puppet theater. But I was thinking, because you said that you maybe ask somebody else to, you are living through, you're living something, some feelings through others. And this is what we do as readers. I read his text this morning about this woman you were referring to, that you heard the voice. This is an old text, isn't it? Yeah. And I was just crying so much. I felt the loss. And this was I was crying for my grandmother and other persons. So in the text, he managed to create, you know. So for me, puppet theater is literature is very much like puppet theater in the sense of my woman, no, my friend, a woman I met in Hungary. She was a psychoanalyst, almost direct from Freud, that worked with puppets and children. So if they had. If they couldn't speak out and tell what was wrong and why they felt so bad, and you know, this loss of this intimacy, they couldn't talk or communicate. It happened. They were more able to speak their truth if they were speaking to a puppet. And telling the puppet the truth somehow. And then they also, sometimes they were also puppet. Their voice was in a puppet. I just wanted to mention this.
Well, in some ways it seems like characters are, I mean, again, by proxy in some ways.
Yeah, but the text that you were so kind to refer to was this, quite similar to when my grandfather passed away, when my friend passed away, my first impulse was to write her back in a way. So I collected the memories of her and I thought that that was her. But that wasn't her. That was me remembering the bits and pieces of her that were okay for me to remember. You know, there were lots of the things that were painful were not in that text. And I think that was kind of one starting point for the novel was that short text, because I realized that there was so much that I was not putting in the text in a way. And the second one was these thoughts about, again with memory, because I had this experience it's very common these days, but I had an experience of an older relative, my grandmother, who very quickly went into dementia, was starting losing her memories. So at one point I had this friend who physically disappeared, and then in parallel I had this old relative who was physically present, like she looked like she always did. She had the same sayings, the same voice, the same smell, like she was here. But then in a matter of months, her memories disappeared. So she went from like 80% memory, 70, 60, 50, 20. And I remember thinking to myself, like, at what point does she cease to be herself? Is she herself with 10% memories? I don't know. And just, it was interesting reading your novel also, but this act of performing, because I realized that when I went to see her, I started performing myself in order for her to recognize me. Like, I started wearing clothes that I didn't hope that she would recognize from before, and that kind of thing. So that also made it into the novel. Like, Samuel has this grandmother who is convinced that she's not losing her memory, but in actuality, she is. And what was interesting, just speaking about writing again, was that she went to writing when memory disappeared. She started labeling her whole house with small notes, because that's how you, because text is stable, right? So I would go over to her and I would realize that she was disappearing because she put like a note on like the salt, you know, here's salt, here's sugar. I remember she put notes on, you know, the TV remote and the cellular phone, because she thought they looked very similar. She couldn't like tell them apart. So she started like, she always tried to change the channel with the phone, and like, so she had like put notes on them. And that was her way of hopefully, yeah, finding some stability in a world where everything felt like it was, how do you say in English, flowing or... dissipating,
shifting.
Yes, thank you.
Meanings, and this idea of performance very much comes into mm-hmm. your novel. At the beginning of the novel, the narrator is basically sent to Greece to look for her, who was her ex-husband at this point, but they've kept it at his request. They've kept it secret from the family, and so she's very much performing the sort of dutiful daughter-in-law, and all of her actions seem prescribed in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing I was interested in thinking about in the book is to what degree when you perform a role, it actually becomes who you are. So I think because so much of how we understand who we are is reinforced through performance, and that eventually if you continue to perform a role, it's very hard to maintain that distinction between the public self you're pretending to be and your private self. And I think our private selves are quite unstable in a lot of ways. You know, it's kind of like the old joke, if you're not in love with your wife, the best way to fall in love with her is to pretend you're in love with her. It's kind of like, that was like the kind of almost like an extended riff in the book. So I was interested in the idea of the kind of pressure, particularly I felt perhaps it's gendered. I wouldn't want to say that definitively, but there's sometimes a pressure to perform your grief, which I thought was really interesting. And my husband actually wrote a novel, his one before the most recent one he published, which is called Gods Without Men. And at the heart of it is a couple whose child disappears. And it was loosely based on the Madeleine McCann story, which was a big story in England. And it was a young girl who was kidnapped or disappeared while her parents were in the same hotel complex. And has never been solved. But there was this incredible pressure on the parents to perform their grief, and particularly the mother. There was a lot of people saying, if she would only cry on television, then we could understand her and people would help her. But because she was completely kind of frozen in her trauma and her grief, and she wasn't able to perform her grief adequately for the television cameras, she was vilified to a certain extent. And I think, you know, we're living in a time when we are constantly performing, you know, for Instagram or Facebook or selfies, we kind of are performing a version of ourselves. And I think if you're not willing to do that, the costs are actually quite high. And I think in their case, it really did tear their family apart. And the other thing I wanted to say about text when you were talking about this is it made me think of a little bit about the kind of private lives of the dead. And one reason why I think we cling to the memories we have of them so tenaciously is because it's very scary when your notion of them becomes unstable, and that can happen in just the most minute way. I mean, I'm thinking of about 5 years after my dad died, I was wearing an old coat of his, and I reached and I took out a shopping list that he'd made, and it was a completely private moment that was not a moment that I had shared with him. And it was not no big revelation. It wasn't like I have another family or, you know, you know, I hate my children. There was no actual core emotional content to it, but just the fact that I had almost managed to convince myself that he didn't have a life that I didn't know about. But of course he did all the time when he wrote down his shopping list, and he did. And so something something about text, I was thinking about your grandmother's notes, and something about these scraps of paper have a kind of funny quality in that. I can't actually tie the two together, but it just...
That would have been such a funny shopping list, right? Go get milk, flour, I hate my children. It's like the basic, normal shopping list. No, but at one point I remember when I went there and I saw all these notes that she put, and I remember the point when I realized that she actually... I convinced myself that it was just, as she said, it was just, you know, I'm a little bit dizzy or whatever. But the one time when I realized that this is actually linked to her safety. So one thing that happens in the novel is that Samuel and his girlfriend... the grandmother leaves her house, and they have this empty house where they get the possibility to make it like a safe space for threatened women, one could say, who don't have economic possibilities. And that happened in our family because my grandmother, at one point, she was not able to take care of herself. She couldn't stay in her house. So we, all of a sudden, we had this empty house, and we were... You know, we in Stockholm, my hometown, every space is linked to economics. You know, like you don't get an empty space. But a lot of my friends work with women who are threatened, and like one impulse in me would be, okay, now we have a house, an empty space. We can actually open it up for people without economic possibilities. And so that's what they do in the novel. We, for practical reasons, and also because we were scared, we weren't able to do that in real life. But in the novel, we could do that. And one of the points when I realized that she was actually not able to take care of herself was when I visited her, and she had put a note on the... She had this house where she had like an alarm, burglary alarm, and with like a code so that you could enter the house if you knew the code, of course. And then she had written a big note with the code on the burglar alarm. So I could see, like, I was knocking the door, she did not answer, and I looked into the window, and I saw, and it actually said, like, låsa av, which is like, unlock the code, like, very instructively. And then there was this four big numbers, like, the code. And then she was very friendly to the potential burglar because she also told him, or her, how to reactivate the alarm. So it's just like, reactivate the alarm, push zero. So you could go in, steal everything, and then go walk out. But to her, that was not, it was not, she could not fathom that that could be read by someone on the outside in a way. So in a way, she was fleeting away from us, and then she went to trying to write herself back, I think.
Yeah. Can I ask them a question?
Yeah, please do.
I just had a question for both of you, because I mean, it's something that I definitely did not even come close to doing in this book, but which is you both kind of feature in your books, and I think that ties to this idea of memory and writing as well, in particular, in some way. And I just wondered, I mean, and you've written a couple books of autofiction as well, and I just wondered how that tied into this kind of act of writing, and how you negotiate that kind of pressure as you're producing the books. So does that make any sense?
Sorry.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's an answer to your question. It's very like a huge question, yeah. But yeah, there is a grandmother also in my book. And I think writers are like that, like your grandmother, trying to like put words on things, write you back. And my grandmother lost track of time. She didn't know if it was day or night. And so her daughter put many clocks on her, like night table. It didn't help her at all. And, you know, sometimes just those words and notes, they don't help you at all. And you read all those books and they do not manage to connect, make this connection somehow to something true. So for me, this is the task of my work, to try to make this connection with words. And then it doesn't matter if it's somehow fictional or not. For me, it's like I live in fictional books also, and I live in a part of my brain is all over. Like, so, you know, it's is this an answer?
Mm-hmm.
No, but I think in both of our works, there is a writer who is kind of a stand-in for ourselves in a way. And I felt when I read your work that it feels very much like a diary, or it feels maybe not, it doesn't feel like you're, it feels like being in your head in a good way. But like, so it feels very much like a diary, but not performative in a way. And I think I used, there is a writer in my work, I think a little bit to have almost like an entry point into the fiction, and also maybe as a way for reminding, in order to remind the reader that this is not the eternal truth about who I am. This writer very quickly becomes, how should I say it, that he's actually... just because he is a writer, we understand that the final truth about him is being revealed towards the end of the novel. I don't know. It sounds cryptic, but it's just because I don't want to spoil anything. So my experience from my first novel, I've always been interested in this, finding different literary forms that create this feeling of authenticity. Like the first novel I wrote was in a diary form, the second was a weird kind of collection of letters, and here there are voices. And if the voices work, if the novel works, I think it works because a potential reader likes to put the voices together. We are not always sure who is speaking. Sometimes, you know, when Lyde says, "I love him," if we know that it's Lyde saying it, the ex-girlfriend, those words, "I loved him," mean something. But since we're not always sure who is speaking, what happens if it's the grandmother who says, "I loved him"? Or what happens if it's the best friend of Samuel, called Vandad, who says, "I loved him"? Like, those words mean something completely different based on who is, which mouth is saying it. And if I don't say, if I don't describe the gender or the sexuality or the age of the person speaking, a potential reader has to listen to what is being said rather than who is saying it. And that's just because I really like those books myself, where I have to create the sender of the message, and I don't, I find myself being invited into creating fiction. It gives me this thing that I in Swedish call legokänslan, like a feeling of Lego when I was a kid, when you were constructing Lego, that I was invited to build fiction. Like when I read Svetlana Alexievich or Roberto Bolaño, that is my feeling, that I'm part of it. The fiction doesn't exist without me as a reader.
Yeah. Now seems like a good time. Then we have time for a couple of questions. Jonas has a panel immediately after this, so we'll try to get through here and have him sign some books. But
we are podcasting this, so I would ask that you wait to ask the question for our microphone runner here to get the microphone to you. And Stephen will recognize the people to ask questions.
Okay. Start up.
It's easy right here in the front. Getting back to something that Miss Ear was saying about playfulness, and you've talked with some depth and with nuanced expressions about trauma and loss, and then I also felt that there were times of movement, possibly even in the direction of not only playfulness but almost, not comedy, but a lightness. And I wonder how that weaves through your process of writing as you go with this, if that's...
Yeah, this would be a good question for Adni to answer. We have the microphone here.
Oh, thank you for a good question, because actually this was what I wanted to say that it is dealing with traumas and something untouchably and unsayably painful, that I think every human has this like space of in him or herself that you just you cannot talk about it. And for me it is important to have this like playfulness, or like this, almost like a comedy. It's not a comedy. To try to have it somehow light. You know, if you lose, if, for example, when you listen to the news today, you get so angry that you just like want to go and write some article and the, and you know, and then you somehow, you are like almost paralyzed of anger. And then you know that there are people that cannot speak for themselves, and so you want to speak for them. And it's like, of course, it's important to do that, maybe to write an article and to write a book and speak out. But I realized that because I studied philosophy and I was in the academy for so many years, and it was so like serious. I was always like talking about democracy and like how we could access the archives. The archives should be part of the public space, something like, you know, it was so heavy that I decided I will just like, when you are in school and then you go out to, you are allowed to play for 15 minutes. So I decided my writing will be that space, you know, that of course I'm treating all those painful and big questions, hopefully, but somehow in a like, yeah, I tried to find this somehow little bit lightness, because the anger paralyzes, you know, takes away my voice.
Yeah. Other questions? In front here.
Thank you all very much for an excellent panel. All of the forms of trauma that you've been discussing seem to focus on individuals and subjective experience of individuals. My question is whether you've ever been tempted to address the issue of collective trauma, and whether you see that as different as it applies to nations or ethnic groups or any group of people in a situation of duress, and whether you think that form of trauma could be addressed through the same types of modes that you've already used in your books.
Jonas, would you? Jonas, when was here a couple of years ago, I actually sat on a panel with him then. He had written a book called The Manticore, which kind of deals in some way with trauma on a larger scale.
Yeah, I think that one of the entry points, it's interesting to hear you speaking about like losing your voice when you're too angry. One of the entry points in, for me, writing was kind of feeling that words really mattered. And one of the things that I did from early on was trying to write about things that was not kind of part of the idealized image of my home country, which is Sweden. And I know that people in the United States, maybe particularly, have a very special paradisical, is that a word in English? Mm-hmm. Or paradise-like image of Sweden. And I have that too. There is a myth about Sweden, but what I find myself writing about is a lot of the things that don't, that are kind of exploding that myth, or trying to write what is behind the official image of, in Manticore, which is a story about a missing father, it was mainly the country, its political past and its discrimination and racism and so on. And in this book, it's more dealing with the physical place of Stockholm. Throughout the novel, we get many different kind of insights into what is not part of the official image of Stockholm. So the slogan for Stockholm is Venice of the North. that's how the tourist board expresses it. And I had a friend who was driving a tourist train going around the city, where there was this pre-recorded voice kind of telling the story about how magnificent and beautiful Stockholm was. Oh, this is amazing. This is the castle. This is the beautiful. This is the a very prominent area. And then the train went up to a hill, and then the voice said, Stockholm, look at her. Isn't she beautiful? And then my friend was like, one day, I swear to you, I'm going to kidnap this train. I'm going to take this train. I'm just going to drive it to the area where I grew up. I'm going to show them what is behind the official image. And he never did that, of course, because that would mean that he would get fired and then lose his pay. But the interesting thing was, what I tried to do in this novel was to show what would have happened if you hijacked that train, like to go behind the official image of a city. And also it gave me the opportunity, Vandad, one of the best friends in the book, at one point he is driving one of those trains and kidnaps it. So the pre-recorded voice says, Stockholm, look at her, isn't she beautiful? But what we are seeing is actually something completely different. So yeah. So I find a lot of energy and a lot of creativity in focusing on what is not too comfortable for the Swedish Prime Minister to talk about, kind of.
Yeah. And Katie, you were, I think maybe you were going to reach for the microphone. So I've gone to the forest, one of your...
I was going to reach for the microphone to say about Montecor. because I actually was the other question I wanted to ask both of them was, is because they both engaged with this idea of history, which I think is where we tend to locate the idea of trauma. And I think, you know, I think in this particular book, it's really about grief to some extent rather than trauma, and I do think they're distinct, and I was curious to hear, you know, about kind of reconstituting a historical narrative, which is what Montecor does. But I was just going to say, I think the book that deals with collective trauma so brilliantly is, the writer is Svetlana Alexievich, and in particular the book about Chernobyl, which is a collection, it's a oral history of people, of a kind of testimony. And it's just, they're just presented as they are. I mean, they must have been edited, I presume, but that seems, it's a kind of choral quality, and it feels like, as a writer, she's helping bear witness to a particular moment and a kind of collective trauma. So that seems to me a very effective non-fictional technique, certainly, yeah, for thinking about trauma, because I think one of the tricky things about fiction is that it's, you naturally create narratives, and obviously the point about trauma in a way is that there is no narrative, or to capture the sense of trauma is when you do not have access to a readily to a narrative that you can understand. And once you do have that narrative, you've kind of progressed towards grief, I think, and you've progressed towards recovery. And I think one thing that's very effective about Alexievich is that there is narrative to each of these little stories, but more or less they are fragments that can't, they don't form a perfect whole, and I think that the holes in the narrative are what make it such a kind of powerful piece of powerful depiction of trauma.
Yeah. I think maybe we have time for...
Just answer it, because it was also a very interesting question. I think for my writing, there is always a little bit of collective trauma behind, or like underneath. The experience for me to go to Hungary just after the communist period, it was very it had a huge influence on me that at this time they were opening up the secret archives. So, you know, the question of if your neighbor had been spying on you and so on, and it was so, I think that it must be a collective trauma. And for example, here in Berkeley, I hear that there are 40 libraries. For me, it's so wonderful. And they are not like libraries of the secret police. Or like, even though they are underground, I saw that there were a lot of them underground. And I felt that this was something for me, I was influenced, this will be in a future book, like all those libraries, and also people that are talking about this. I talked to those Mexican-American men about this possible wall. And like, what a horrible idea and traumatic, you know. So I thought, like, okay, the only wall possible is wall of books. And
okay, maybe one more question, and then I think we have.
This is maybe a quick question. Katie mentioned nonfiction, and so I just wanted to ask you to be completely honest. Have you ever thought about writing nonfiction, or did you ever think about these stories being written in nonfiction?
I'm very bad at nonfiction. I find I get very self-conscious, and I wish I wasn't. I was just asked to write something to give a lecture in Italy, and I almost had to say no, because I said this will take me, you know, 6 months of the year to write a 2,000-word nonfiction text. I think I'm not quite there yet as a writer. I mean, it's interesting because there are now increasingly so many writers are using nonfiction techniques in their novels, and I think that's a real kind of trend in writers like Ben Lerner, Teju Kolk, I mean, Knausgård, they all do this. So, I mean, it's certainly the appropriation of non-fictional techniques in a piece of fiction is interesting to me. But I think I'm not sufficiently evolved as a person to reach a state of writing non-fiction.
No, I've only written like shorter, more political pieces that were can maybe be labeled as nonfiction, and I could really relate to what you said about playfulness. Like that my entry point is very often finding a space of freedom and finding a place where I can play. That's my entry mode when it comes to writing fiction, and I feel very crippled by this idea that it has to be true in the objective sense of the word. So I'm going to stick with either plays or novels is are the forms that appeal the most to me.
Okay. Yeah, I say my books are nonfiction and fiction. Yeah. So if you ask me if it's nonfiction, I say yes. And if you ask me, is it fiction, I say yes. But it gets a little bit problem. It's okay when you're just writing about yourself, because you are like, you can tell all the, you can describe yourself in a bad way, and it doesn't matter. But if you are talking about other people, and you are saying this is autobiography, this is nonfiction, and you are talking about the problems of somebody else in your life, then it gets automatically very problematic. And that's actually very traumatic for a writer to publish such a book and thinking that it's really making a beautiful picture of everybody and really trying to, and then you find out that somebody is being hurt. So it's not a reason to write only about yourself, but you have to take care. Yeah. So it is an important. Even though I say yes and yes, it is sometimes I say no. This is fiction. Yeah. No. This is fiction. And so I probably would. Yeah.
Well, thank you all. And just to remind you that just across the way, just directly across from the building is where the signing will take place after this. And I'd like to thank Katie and Jonas and Adney very much for their time.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.